Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG Pod Overflow, the Cinephobe Cold Opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
You said the OG Pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG Pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing it, and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG Pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
It's Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz.
And I'm Tom Haberstroh.
Tom, craft cocktails, canapes, who knew? Big week on Top Chef, season 16. Brother Luck back in the competition. All kinds of shenanigans happening in that Last Chance Kitchen. You got to keep an eye on that Last Chance Kitchen, man. Are you going to miss everything? Tom, impressions.
I didn't know what a canapé was until I watched this episode. So when she's like, all right, we're going to be doing a canapé for guests in the basement of the Seelbach Hotel, which, by the way, has one of the best bourbon selections in the world. Go check out the Seelbach bar there in downtown Louisville. What's the difference between a canapé and a mousse bouche?
I mean, mousse bouche would be part of kind of like a seated dinner. A canapé is a specific little morsel. I mean, it's an hors d'oeuvre. I don't think it. I mean, I knew what I'd heard the term before. I didn't know. I don't think it specifically goes with a cocktail, but it is something. It is more of an hors d'oeuvre. It is more of whereas the amuse is sort of usually part of a more structured meal, but. That was the assignment, right? You got it. They threw out five great craft cocktails, and the contestants each had to choose a cocktail with which they would pair or be inspired by to do, as Tom Colicchio called it, kind of the one true bite, like just a bite, a very similar to the amuse. You're absolutely right. But, and then that was the assignment, and then hijinks ensues as it always does.
Yeah, there was a similar episode last season where they had to make a Radler inspired dish. It was really good, except Chris Scott, who's no longer drinks alcohol. He's like, I guess I just kind of wing it here. We didn't have that twist in this episode. Everyone brought their best, and so many dishes, and we'll get into it, that I just wanted to, I don't even know, chew, drink, lather it down, and it was, it looked great. So as someone who likes to pair a cocktail with dinner, a nice glass of wine, this was a very inspired episode for me. With these cocktails. And I learned, I didn't know what these like 12 Mile High cocktails were. Just the 12 Mile High one looked kind of like a Long Island iced tea. It just looked like a bunch of liquors.
Yeah, it's in- a pour all the shit in the well in one glass, right?
Yeah.
Like that's kind of, so there was also another twist to this episode, which was Brother Luck came out of the loser's bracket. He is Last Chance Kitchen extraordinaire competitor. Beat out Nene to be the contestant let back in the competition. And there was a little bit of, gotta say, like, not a huge fan of the Kelsey Sarah, we don't want your kind here. The very tribal thinking of sort of that they took great umbrage at Brother Luck coming back in the competition. And actually half of the existing contestants had to be his sous chef in the head-to-head against Nene to see who would come back in. It was essentially Last Chance Kitchen was exported out of the digital ether and into your living rooms as part of the main episode this week. So that was kind of funky, kind of cool, but there was definitely sort of a bias against Brother Luck for being a member of season 15 rather than a season 16 purist. Kelsey and Sarah. So again, expressing the we don't want your kind here, but Brother Lux prevailed, as he is wont to do, as he is Last Chance Kitchen master, and was the 11th contestant after to join the 10 survivors.
What an amazing performance by Brother to get back in the competition. Reminds me of like Jimmy Butler getting traded to the 76ers and has to play like the next night without knowing any of the teammates, doesn't know any of the sets, doesn't know the strengths and weaknesses, what they want, how they want it. And then he overcomes that handicap and goes in back into the competition and gets booted for the same reason he did last season. Poor Brother Luck. Obviously, if you're listening to this show, you know that there are spoilers here. But Brother, it was like watching someone fight all the way back from an injury, coming back and then getting re-injured for a similar thing that was the previous injury and an aggravation, and just be like, ah, he was so close, so close.
Right. And so just to explain, this is where Brother Luck gets into it. This is his great Achilles heel in the competition is last year it was the parameters of the challenge, I believe, were to make something German inspired and Bavarian inspired. And he did these sort of, quote, German egg rolls that had basically they were about as German as they were about as German as something, but they just were not very German.
Oh, that's a good one.
They were about as German as Xi'an province and his German egg rolls just in, and there's a certain insult you see, especially Tom. Like, I mean, Tom's subtext is often, look, asshole, like, we set these parameters for a reason. This isn't, these aren't suggestions. These are prescriptions, right? Like, we want you to do X. So, like, you can color outside the lines a little bit. And Brother Luck went home because his German egg rolls, again, were just not specifically or even implicitly German. And this week it was, hey, do your canopy and create a canopy that is a callback or inspired by or a nod to the cocktail. And what was it? Was it South? What was the name of the cocktail he was supposed to use?
I don't even know, but there was not
south
even a
side,
hint of it.
A South Side something.
Yeah.
And he's like, South Side something? Hey, Southeast Asia. Hey, Banh Mi. And the next thing you know, there was like this very spiced beef liver parfait with peanuts that could not have been any less of a tribute or to the cocktail in question. And you could see Tom kind of pissed off. Like, we gave you these parameters for a reason. Like, we sit around a producer's table and think about these things, and you kind of ignore them. So unfortunately, Brother Luck went home, and there were a lot of really good looking bites on that table. And I gotta say, Tom, the headline here is Eric. I have been calling him a sleeping giant. He is
Holy
on my team.
Yeah.
He is the Mike Conley of Top Chef 16. He was the best chef not to have won squat. And decides he's going to shuck. I get very nervous when someone has to shuck oysters against the clock. I don't know about you, Tom, but like I was sweating that. Because like shucking oysters is hard. And I have my little glove and I have my little thingy. And it's hard work.
It's like watching a horror movie where you know the killer's in the closet.
You know? You can't get the car started. No, it's that. Yeah, like and it's like a horror movie where you're sitting in the cabin of the car, turning the keys, and it won't start. And here he comes with the chainsaw.
Yeah, it's like, oh, this is going to be bad. Like Eric's going to lose a hand. And the other thing is, shucking that many oysters, you can't fake it. You can't like. We'll get into Brian. By the way, we're going to have two special guests here in a second, but yes, you can't do what Brian did and just like throw gnocchi into the frying pan or the fryer and then like put it on a plate. You can't have, you can't not shuck.
Right.
There's like, no shortcut to this.
Yeah. You're either, it's a very binary thing. Either an oyster is shucked or it is not. And by the way, Tom, I thought of you really, because that rum bourbon mignonette, I mean, that is a bite designed for Tom Haberstroh. I got to say, like that lovely mignonette he did. With the rum and the bourbon, I am so happy for Eric because again, as we've said, I think on average he has been cooking as good a food as anyone on the show, dish in, dish out. He has not had a misfire, and I think he's been above 500 in every single exercise. But
Kevin,
but
I have my in my won. Notes here. I have in my notes best dish of the season.
Oh, see, that had you written all over. Oh. I saw that. And
it was beautiful. It's a bite. It's au naturel in the shell. I loved everything about that. And shouts to Eric. That was not just the – it was one of those – of all the dishes that we've seen this season, Kevin, that was the one that gave me the most FOMO that I wasn't there to eat it. You know, like I just want to try that.
I have to say I was really – and I have a as you know, a weakness for scallop crudo in general. And I thought Kelsey did the most gorgeous, beautiful looking thing I've seen on the show in a while. Her scallop crudo with a kind of a rhubarb consommé she did in a corn puree and had this lovely, I think it was a chive, just kind of delicately balanced over the spoon, and it was just a really beautiful thing. She got in the top three, and man, I could eat Eddie's food all day. And I know, I'm taking victory laps on Eddie. Everybody thinks he's a maniac. Everybody thinks he's a stress monkey. And you know what? Like all that guy does is stress his way to the judges' table every week. And he had that bourbon cured salmon with a peach puree. I love salmon. It's so fatty. It's so nice. You know, it just picks up the richness. Eddie once again looked like a deer in the headlights and just stressed his way into the final.
The scene of the rested mean face when they were like, Eddie is so glorious. I've come around on him. I was doubling down. I was so indentured. I was basically saying I am so embedded into this idea that he is my enemy because I am so opposite side to you on Eddie. And now I can't even do it. I can't even hate on him. The whole rested mean face, I think I'm stuck on resting mean face, was such a great scene when they were just like, you look upset. I'm like, what's wrong? And he's like, this is just how I look. I'm sorry.
But I relate to it. I feel like I'm that guy in a lot of situations, yeah. Tom. I feel like I'm that guy in the press room. Like, I feel like...
Why are you so upset, Kevin?
Yeah,
I'm not.
Why are you so
stressed?
Why are you so serious?
Delightful. Yeah.
You know, like, and I kind of identify with Eddie. And he's also a short man, and I'm a short man. And so, Kevin,
I have a question here.
Yes.
Do these chefs figure out a hack? Because did you notice one commonality with those three dishes?
Raw seafood.
Seafood.
200 people. And it's funny too, Tom, because I thought about this. Adrian at one point says to David, who also did a cold dish. I don't think it was entirely raw. His shrimp, they were in the Gin Ricky department or division. And she said, oh, easy for you to say with your cold food. And I'm thinking, yeah, like that wasn't mandatory. You don't have to go to the fire. Like you don't have to do hot food.
Exactly.
I mean, nobody is like, because she said it as if she kind of got like she drew the bad knife, right? And I don't mean this as a knock on Adrian specifically, but it was a very telling moment where she was much more hectic and under a lot more stress than he was, And David didn't finish in the top three, but and it's sort of like, yeah, but I mean, that's strategy. Cold food is easier.
I mean, you know, the old saying, as you love to say, this isn't top scallop, but I'm kind of feeling like it is. I'm kind of feeling like top crudo, you know?
I would watch a season of top scallop, wouldn't you?
Yes, yes. Yeah, and then we'll get into the greasy sponge, I believe, how it was described by Padma, Brian's dish, the greasy sponge. Sarah, it was mush on mush on mush. And then Brothers, which just was way overpowering heat and also way overpowering out of left field.
A lot of gun thing. In fact, Tom, I believe we could actually go right to the source on gnocchi and sausage. Because if I'm not mistaken, we are joined now by chefs Brian Young and chef Justin Sutherland, who I think quite possibly produced the fourth best dish in Top Chef history, judging from the response to the crostini.
The best honorable mention in history. Yes. Let's get them on the line.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us. Yeah, yes. Thanks for having us.
And Brian, you don't know, but we have met.
We met?
And the reason we have met is we were one of your tables at Northeast.
Oh, that's funny. How was it?
You know what? I'm saying this not to flatter you. Like, when people, because, you know, people wanted to know how the experience was. Tom's gotten it too from all our friends. And it's, and you know, ultimately it's, well, how was the food? And I'm like, the food was fantastic.
Oh, that's awesome.
Like, I mean, there were six really good dishes. Even the one that we jokingly call the Forgotten Crudo, which was Eddie's Crudo.
Yeah.
Which, it was perfectly decent, but like,
I thought it was the weakest.
Yeah. Like it was, but I think it says a lot that it was the weakest of the six, and it was still like a really nice plate.
It was still awesome.
So we have met and you came by and you were front of the house, model citizen.
Were you guys the last?
Yes.
Were you guys like one of the last tables?
Yes. And actually Eric and Adrian and Eddie like came out to like greet us or like join in on the conversation we were having. And then they were like ushered away by PR people.
I know.
Well, like, you can't be here.
They don't let us talk to anybody.
And Justin, I think you were somewhere else in the room biting Nini's head off.
Yes. Yes. I apologize for that. But it was
the whole day was just crazy. And it was the one thing. I mean, I always said, you know, going on to the show, I was like, if I make it to Restaurant Wars, then I'll be happy. I don't want to leave before Restaurant Wars, because that's like,
and then
to me,
and then it happened
like
so early.
I know, man. But I was still so psyched, like when it happened.
You were so psyched that you wrote a 50-page manual. So, Justin, did you ever get a chance to see Chef Brian's manual?
I did. It was illustrated. It had chapters. This man did not sleep all night. He's insane.
This is like officially the Dead Sea Scrolls of Top Chef now, right?
Oh,
yes. This manual.
I think we should put it into production. I guarantee you we could sell it.
I have a theory about Restaurant Wars, and it's actually something Tom and I have been discussing, and I kind of wanted to run it by you.
Okay.
And it's also because we were able to do a little reporting and sort of, you know, understand that these aren't necessarily folks who necessarily have restaurant experience. Would the entire competition be different if y'all were furnished with like experienced wait staff, where basically it strikes me, I would love to see just as a contrast, because I almost think there's an element of sabotage, and it 100%. Might just be staffing issues, like it's a Saturday night, like where are you going to find any people who do this for a living or are employed, and it's not like restaurants are going to shut down to furnish you with their finest servers. It's just, but it is something we had talked about where it almost seems like it's destined to be a disaster, because, look, this is actually a skill that people have or they don't. I mean, it's not something that anybody can do.
100%. I agree completely. And I'll be honest with you. You know, I mean, the service staff that we were supplied, they were banquet servers or people who work at banquets. So, you know, they had like, they know how to carry a tray, but, you know, they're not used to being in a fine dining environment. Like they don't, it was really interesting. They didn't know about, you know, clearing
any steps of service,
clearing flatware. Or
anyway,
by the way, we should also say absolutely some of the most lovely people. I mean, they could not have been nicer.
They were, yeah, they were great. Not for the most. I think I fired somebody that didn't even actually work for me.
Did you really?
I did.
That's amazing.
I told someone to go home. I was like, I
what?
Can't with you.
Did you say pack your knives and go home?
I said pack your knives and go.
Please pack your knives and go.
When you're watching, guys, when you're watching Restaurant Wars, we were there. We experienced it. The biggest difference that I saw from the edited version on TV to my own experience, the reality, was that we were really backed up. And we had like a 90-minute wait to go to Northeast. And Brian, you can probably speak to that more. But I felt like there was an advantage to getting the judges table first, and then they make their way to the second restaurant and the third restaurant. That was the biggest difference, was there was nothing on the show that spoke to how much of a backup there was at Northeast. And I'm guessing there was a backup everywhere, of course, at your restaurant, Justin. But what was – Justin, we'll start with you. The thing that we didn't get to see at home that you were like, oh, wow, they just missed that whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that. I think the real intensity of the backup. And like you said, I think when the judges came, played a huge part, cause not that you could, you know, you still had the complete service and, you know, but there was kind of that exhale moment of, all right, set the judges. That's the one that counts. If everything goes to shit now, you know, at least we saved that. So yeah, it was just intense. The entire day, I think the amount of hours. Yeah, we were on, I think we were on a 90 minute wait at some point.
I just brought wine glasses to the line and started pouring people like rosé while they were standing and waiting. Cause I'm like, what else am I going to do? I can't make people leave.
And there's a sauna in there too.
Oh, and we have the guy in our dining room who brought his own banana in protest. For he was sitting. It was. I mean, I feel like he was a plant. First of all, who brings a banana to a restaurant? He's sitting right next to the judge.
Well, no.
Right,
so, Justin, a little backstory. Table. We might be able to help you with that.
Okay.
So,
you bring a banana?
One of the things that happens. No, I didn't bring a banana, but I actually frequently bring bananas. It's a great source of potassium, and I'm a runner, and I'm old. But so. It's actually kind of ironic. So before people are brought into your restaurants, there's this holding tank, which is a warehouse on the same site as the restaurants, like right across the way.
Right.
I mean, you're in there prepping. You didn't see any of this. And it's actually it's split down the middle. One is production and the other is the holding tank where they have literally snacks from Costco. So your first exposure to food in the Top Chef Restaurant War guest experience is basically various
Funyuns. It was a bunch of munchies.
Yeah, basically Funyuns. I mean, basically just chips and granola bars that you would find at Costco or Sam's Club. and some very standard fruit. So that is where I think it came, and it is a bit of a ordeal. I mean, you get called, your reservation isn't. I mean, again, there wasn't a lot of science to this, and I think it's also intentional. I mean, they want to.
Oh yeah, they wanted to put us into the most intense situation they could, and they succeeded.
So I think to me, like the advantage of having the judges table now, I basically planned on the judges coming at the worst possible time. I just knew that that's what was going to happen. I'm just naturally a suspicious person, so I'm like, they're going to come right in between the first and second seating. Like when we're in the weeds with first courses and trying to get people out. And, you know, I spent all night poring over the books and I figured out, I was like, hey guys, you know, like, I don't think the judge's reservation is in here, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think scared everybody. You remember, I mean, the morning before we left, everybody was scrambling, freaking out. And if I hadn't been so obsessive compulsive, I wouldn't have caught it.
But so what was in the manual? I'm curious, what was in the manual?
Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher-turned-podcast producer, and I'm here to talk to you about ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high-quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep, free shipping, vacuum-sealed packaging, It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise. But maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order. Hello, listener. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that we at Cinephobe love our pets. Zach and Boogie are inseparable. I've got two cats and a dog, and Amin is giving his best ass on performance to convince dog owners that he loves their pet.
Hey, little, hey, boy, how you doing? And Noodles is like,
ah, whatever. Which is why today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. For many pet parents, summer is all about making travel plans like adventuring through the national parks, visiting pet-friendly beaches, or road tripping across the country. Wherever your journeys take you and your furry friend, you can help protect them along the way with a plan from ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
What was in? So like, basically,
what are you writing down? Why do you have illustrations and whatnot?
You drew so pictures of napkin folds and spoons and how to set a table.
I did. I drew a table setting. Where the wine glasses would go. So that basically all I had to do was I had to show one person and then they would always have the book to reference. So, you know, the other thing is the, you know, it was really a lot about, you know, all the way down, you know, from service style to, you know, the proper way to address the table or the proper way to greet somebody when you go up to a table, all the way through, you know, if somebody orders red wine, you know, the table is already set with red and white wine glasses. So, you know, how to properly clear the white wine glass away, you know, or not to try to take people's plates before the whole table is done. And these are just like basic principles, you know, in fine dining. And I think I just assumed that the service staff that I would get would not know how to do these things. And I wanted to make sure that my bases were covered. So, yeah. You know, and then, you know, even how to thank people before they leave and things like that. So it was really, it was obsessively in depth. I would say it was.
I will say in Nini's defense, she couldn't teach anybody a table number because I don't think we had tables in our restaurant until 11 minutes before service started. They were so behind in the design and the setup of our restaurant. I definitely feel better in that situation because she couldn't begin the training. She couldn't say, hey, this is table one when there was no table one.
Justin, Jay Snaps, what was the moment you snapped? Like, what was the precise moment where it was like, you know what, F this. I can't be Mr. Nice Guy anymore. I'm going to go ape shit on you guys.
You know, I think it was when the sixth plate of food came back to the kitchen because they couldn't find the table. They didn't know the table number. They were just bringing food to random tables. Yeah, and I definitely had a lost it moment. Kelsey calmed me down, but I was just watching all of them. I mean, because David's over there busting his ass, and he's cooking both entrees. You know, we're shucking oysters to order. We knew it was going to be intense, but watching all of that work come back to the kitchen got very frustrating.
Speaking of which, we just watched Eric, who's got to be in the Olympics for oyster shucking. I did notice you, Justin, I think you had a little bandage on your finger. Did you have a shucking accident?
I don't think it was a shucking accident. I think it was a knife slip when I was cutting that duck.
Oof.
Pretty sure that, yeah.
Oh.
Pretty sure that's what it was.
And by the way, I have a theory that your crostini or your duck a la orange bite was the best dish ever in Chop Chef that didn't get to the judges' table, because the way they were kind of swooning about it on camera, and it looked just beautiful. I mean, that is a dish made for me. And then, you know, it was a strong field. It was a top heavy field on the canapé episode.
To be honest, I honestly felt the same way. I felt very good. I mean, all the judges' responses to me were great. I thought it was a great dish. So, you know, just a matter of one of those times where there were a lot of great dishes and not all of them could make it.
What is the experience of viewing the season? Because obviously this is months ago, and obviously it's reality TV. And so episodes are kind of cobbled together, and the sausage is made a very specific way. And what is it like? What's the experience of watching it kind of delivered to you? And I assume you haven't seen the episodes any sooner than I do.
No, we're seeing them for the first time when you see them. Yep. I think the biggest thing is figuring out which storylines they're going to run with. You know, I mean, it's 17, 18 hours of filming some days that gets edited down to, you know, 48 minutes. So it's very interesting to see what makes the cut, what they want to run with, who's going to be the asshole that week. It's very interesting, because then you have flashbacks of that day, and you're like, yeah, it's nuts.
The editing to me has been the most interesting part. It's you know, it's just been how they chop it up. I agree with Justin 100%. You know, because you remember, you know, like things you said in the moment. You're like, oh God, I hope they don't. I hope they don't show me saying that. You know,
yeah.
Right? And then, you know, sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't. You know what I mean? And we're lucky that we all have. We've been running with basically a group text stream, you know, that we're always texting each other like, you're like, yo, you know, I didn't mean to say that. Like, I was in a moment, I was upset. And everybody's been a really good sport.
Are there moments where you're like, wait a minute, I forgot I said that about Nini?
Yep. Yes. Or just our people in general, or sometimes you forget that you have a microphone on and you're like, shit.
Everybody. Right. I mean, the thing is you just forget that they're there. After a while, you just forget that they are even present, and you're just in the weeds, scrambling, like living your life. And all of a sudden you're like, oh, I may have just said something mean, and the camera was right on me when I said it.
Yeah.
Or there have been a few instances.
Does a very good job of making themselves invisible at the right times.
Right.
So you're basically just cooking and living in a panopticon for
100%,
basically.
Absolutely. It's like it's a 100% fishbowl. And
did you have like After Effects where you would go into like real life and just always feel like there's a camera following you?
Oh, absolutely. I think for me, the most hilarious thing was when, you know, when they ask you a question, you have to, you know, you need to answer the question in a complete sentence. And so the funniest adjustment for me after, you know, 2.5 months was, you know, being back in the real world and realizing that I don't have to answer everyone's question starting with the question.
Oh, so like when, hey, what was your thinking about that dish? My thinking on the dish was you have to
always, because they don't hear the question being asked. They just hear the answer. So you have to phrase it so the people at home know where it's stemming from.
Did you have to go for like a week of training on how to be a Top Chef contestant, on like how to answer questions and what to watch out for on those things?
It happened in the moment. There was a lot of coaching, you know, how to phrase things.
Yeah. That's great.
Absolutely. I mean, it was weird at first. I mean, and then they were like, oh, you know, say exactly what you just said again, except for I need you to say it a different way, you know? And so,
right.
You know, I mean, those interviews that they chomp up, and use. I mean, you could be in an interview room for 3 or 3.5 hours, and they just want that, you know, they want that one
that
sound.
One,
they want to get you.
Yep.
So it's really weird. And
that's why you're always in that jean jacket there, Brian.
It's funny. Some of the rooms were freezing cold, the interview rooms. And some of the other ones were like 100 degrees.
Hell.
So when we look all greasy and sweaty, it's like, it's not because they're filming it like right after it happens. It's because like literally there's like bright light. It's like 100 degrees. It's just crazy.
I haven't been able to go back into a Whole Foods since. I have PTSD every time I do a Whole Foods.
Same.
Hey Brian, I want to ask you about we're just coming off of the canopy episode. Defending one's dish when you're on the bottom is always a tricky exercise.
Yeah,
and I'm trying to do they take because I think there's a sort of a negotiation you have to make with yourself, which is, do I own up to my errors when they come to the, did you think that dish was good? Did you taste it? You know, and what was interesting is during the, because in the interview you were kind of like, I put all the sausage on the grill at once. It was a hack move. I ended up having to kind of fry my gnocchi. They edited it as if you were sort of watching the downward spiral of your dish, which was just a manifestation of time management and whatever else. But then you decided to take the tack of, hey, I thought my dish was great.
You know, it's funny. I did taste the dish altogether, and it made sense. You know, I think in hindsight, I was just really scared. First of all, I think I was scared that the gnocchi would end up being like in that little cup that I had to serve with. I was worried that they would steam in there and get like weird and soggy. So, gummy. So I decided to fry them because I was like, well, that way they'll be crispy all the way around. Now, you know, you would think like in a Top Chef kitchen, there would be like nice, you know, pristinely clean, like frying oil. You know, that's not the case. So it was just kind of like, it was kind of skanky old oil. And I, you know, by the time I realized it's like, oh, well, this kind of tastes like a fryer, you know, it's too late. So you just have to back yourself up. You know, basically, and, you know, being at the judges table, you know, it's something that I actually got kind of good at where I could maneuver and talk my way out of things, which I think.
That's why you're front of house. Film. Yep.
Yep. I think you should always defend your decisions.
What do you guys eat? Like what and where and how do you guys eat on the show?
Mostly we ate like. We had some weird food. It was not like you would think.
You can say it, Brian. I think they picked the worst catering company in Kentucky to feed us.
It was
sorry. It was brutal. I mean, I think Eddie lost 20 pounds. He would not eat the food. He was just like, I'm not eating this garbage.
So there wasn't any of this. You know, you have romantic notions of 10 chefs in a house. Maybe you rotate nights and you guys do these lovely.
We did do that.
Okay, so you got to do a little bit of that. All right.
Yeah, but on set, not great.
On set, it's like the worst corporate like luncheon food.
Yes. Oh yeah, like our favorite days were days where they would get us like pizza or. Like, Padma bought everybody Indian takeout one day, which was actually
it was amazing.
That was probably my favorite day on set. But
it sounds like you're on like
I think that happened after we like boycotted the food, and I think we, you know, we did a hunger strike, and then Padma bought us like, good Indian food.
Oh, there was a hunger strike. So this was like there was a consensus here. This was an undercurrent of production was y'all's dissatisfaction with the food.
Yeah, ooh, it was rough.
I'm Tom. This is like eating in the Miami Heat press room every night.
I know, but it's especially cruel when you're doing it to chefs. It's like giving. It's like playing an all-star game in the NBA and giving them like a flat basketball.
Exactly.
It's like, well, it's so mean. Like we just got all these like amazing chefs in a room, and they could be creative. And thank you for being so awesome at your jobs. And here, by the way, is a flat basketball. You know,
I know you guys are up against it, Justin. I want to do some. I haven't been to Minneapolis since October of 2016, but it has kind of become one of my favorite food cities on the NBA circuit. And I mean, I have like a list of places I love, from Corner Table to Safari, which is a Somali restaurant that I really liked.
We just, you know, Brian and I just ate at Thomas Bamer's new restaurant in Bloom.
Which is incredible. Table. So I got to do that next time I'm in town. Okay.
So
it blew me out of the water. I got to tell
you. You know, have wonderful, always have wonderful meals at Spoon and Stable. You know, it's just like, it's a great, it's a really underrated food scene. I mean, I think, you know, I think when a place is under kind of a blanket of snow for half the year, you just assume there's nothing. It's not fertile ground, literally. And so,
No, we have a phenomenal, phenomenal food scene.
So you don't love Boston, though. I think did I hear that or did I read that?
Oh, Kevin,
you're not a big fan of Boston.
Brian, I think I told you this when you came to the table. I am a Boston fan. My dad is from Cohasset outside of Boston, and he grew me up as a Boston sports fan. I actually lived in Connecticut, so it wasn't like I lived in Boston. But Kevin, I'm just gonna put you on the spot. I don't think he's a big fan, and he can justify it. He has very good reasons for this, but he also probably hasn't eaten at one of your restaurants, Brian.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, I'm not great with kind of old Irish bro-y towns in general, like. And it's like, and I grew up in the South and live in California, so I'm not good with cold weather. And like, it's
getting around is a pain in the ass. Yeah.
Like it's tribal, it's old. Like by the way, I had a great omakase at Oh Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. Like it's not like I haven't had good meals in Boston, but I also think like you go into the White Hen and they want like $2.99 for a bottle of, it's like everything's expensive. The drivers are awful. Yep. Everybody looks like Eric Stoltz in Mask. You know, like, it's just a bunch of drunken dudes walking around on a Friday night at 11 p.m. when you're leaving the arena with your briefcase.
This sounds fun to me. This is like, you're right. Like, it is
I'm
tribal.
Just, that's what, I'm just not that, a Boston
that's what I
guy.
Love about it.
No, and to each his own, right? Like, I would never prescribe Los Angeles for like most sane people I know. Like, not every city's for everybody. And like, some of my best friends are Bostonians and they love it. You know, like. But for me, it's just not my town. Like, Chicago's not my town either. For many of the same reasons I don't like Boston. You know, I'm a little precious. Like, you're talking to somebody
because
who likes
you hate the Irish. Is that it?
Because I hate the Irish. I am, but it is sort of this, that's it. It's just an aesthetic thing, and it's just a matter of taste. And and then it kind of became part of my persona among my peers. So now it's like I just shit on Boston.
And also,
Brian, their sports fans are, if you're like just a kind of a sober like sports writer who tries to bring some degree of nuance and sanity to the conversation, Boston is not terribly a hospitable place for that message. Like this is a like it's like
Yankees suck. Yankees suck. You don't think that that's a nuanced argument?
Yeah. So it's just. But I've had great meals in Boston, and I know great people in Boston.
Well, we're gonna settle this next time you're in Boston. We're in late spring. I'm actually opening a restaurant called the Emery.
No way. What neighborhood?
So you are gonna have to come in, and then I'll show you like the non bro-y part.
So what neighborhood is your restaurant gonna be in?
It's in Beacon Hill.
Okay. Ooh.
So
which is not far from
it's at the top of Beacon Hill on Beacon Street, like right behind the new State House. So we're really very excited about it. And I would love to have you in and change your mind.
No,
maybe.
That was great.
We'll see.
Listen, one of my favorite Boston restaurants actually in Somerville, and that is Sarma.
Okay, which Sarma is so amazing.
Sarma is amazing. And you know what's amazing about Sarma in addition to everything they do? They have a no cilantro menu.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think that I think the Food and Drug Administration should require every restaurant to have.
Have a cilantro free section.
A cilantro. I need to know where it is on your menu. You don't have to make food cilantro free, but I need to know where it is and where it's not. And I just think Sarma. I go every I basically go kind of the fourth Friday in February every year because I'm up there for a conference, and I go out to Somerville and do my Sarma run.
Hey, guys, I'm wondering, we've had guests on the show, Chef Testins, before, and one of my favorite questions to ask is whether you guys did any prep for the show. Like, did you scout out a Whole Foods and try to figure out where everything is? Did you like, put yourself through a boot camp of learning how to put together a dish in under 6 minutes? Like, what sort of things did you do from finding out you were going to be on Top Chef to actually going to Game Time?
I mean, me personally, I didn't do any. I mean, I was busy running a really busy restaurant, so it was just kind of like the date's getting closer, and then I had to leave. So, but I mean, we were doing course dinners for, 100, 150, 160 people, every night. And, it's the busy season, you know what I mean? In Boston, that's the busy season, spring and early summer. So I didn't have time to do anything. I know that for sure Adrian did a lot of prep. She did a lot of like quick fire practicing and things like that. That I wish I had done. You guys have watched the show. Quick yes. fires are definitely not my forte. So, maybe me I should have practiced in hindsight. I don't know. Did you do anything, Justin?
And I didn't have any time. I mean, I was pretty fresh off of Iron Chef. So I had had that win under my belt and knew that I could, perform quickly and under pressure. But other than that, I was in the middle of opening my second restaurant, in which I had to leave for Top Chef before we even were able to get it open. So I was deep into opening a restaurant. So I didn't have much time to think about it, which I think was good.
But before we let you go, tell us about your project.
Yeah. So the second restaurant there that I opened, called Pearl and the Thief, kind of a Gulf Coast Southern, theme, very seafood, big oyster bar. Just really celebrating the fresh seafood that comes out of the Gulf there. So everything from New Orleans, South Carolina, going fantastic. Actually, in the process of relocating it. When I was gone, I opened it in a small town called Stillwater in Minnesota, and we are moving it to Minneapolis right now.
Wait, it's Stillwater? Stillwater is that the place where it's a little bit out of town. I keep getting ads on Instagram for like cute boutique hotel in Stillwater. And is that
That's
like
exactly what it is?
Do they just identify the yuppie gay guy who spends all his money on food and travel and say you should be going here?
You are born for Stillwater.
Okay, that's it. Because I was actually antiquing
and
exactly.
Yeah.
Like, by the way, that's how creepy kind of digital life is now. It's like they know right. that like, oh yeah, here's a no child, child free, double income, no kids, gay couple that likes going to food and boutique hotels and lifestyle whoring. Let's send them to a hotel in Stillwater, Minnesota. I didn't even know what Stillwater was. And then someone explained it to me. So that's where your restaurant is. And now you're going to St. Paul?
Minneapolis. No, my other restaurants are in St. Paul. Moving Pearl and the Thief to downtown Minneapolis.
Nice. Well, very good. Next time we are in town for a Timberwolves game, which should be 2031.
Do you have any NBA takes that you want to pop off on this podcast, guys?
Yeah, here's your chance.
I mean, I'm a big Timberwolves fan, so I stick with them.
Wait, are you pro Tibbs firing, or are you happy that Flip Saunders' son is getting the chance? Like, where were you on the Tom Thibodeau drama?
I think getting fired after a pretty big win kind of burned. But I'm like, yeah, great job tonight. You don't work here anymore. So that was kind of weird. Super stoked for Flip's son though. Flip had an amazing legacy and I'm excited to see what he does with it.
Yeah. I think Ryan's going to be a good coach.
Yeah, he is. Yep. Yeah.
I think so too.
Gentlemen,
conversely,
of course Kevin cuts off
God,
the Boston.
I have to hear another, just what the world needs, more Boston sports takes. Yes, okay.
Yeah, right. Oh no. I'll be honest with you. I actually grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, and we didn't have a basketball team growing up. I am still a rabid New England Patriots fan. I just was growing up. So that's very annoying for everyone.
Yes, it is.
But as far as basketball goes, I never played it.
I mean, you're like.
I think Brian's the tallest person to never play basketball.
Wow.
It's true.
Yeah.
I'm not good at it.
How tall are you?
I'm 6'7", Brian. So that's average height for the NBA.
That's pretty
six
tall.
6'7".
Do people look at you when you walk into a room and you're like, "Ooh, is that guy an NBA player? Did he play college basketball?"
That's what happened in Macau. Everybody thought that I was Birdman because I just have tattoos.
Everyone thought you were Chris Anderson.
Oh my God.
That's great. That's my favorite thing I've ever heard on this show.
People were pointing at me going like, Birdman, Birdman. And I was like, yeah, man. Go and take pictures with me and stuff. It was awesome.
Did you know who Birdman was?
Yeah. I mean, I knew who they were accusing me of being, that was just really funny. And now my thing is, you know, walking into a room, I can't tell if people are staring at me because I'm freakishly tall or if they recognize me from Top Chef. So that's like the new, you know, that's like the new question, the silent question always hanging in my mind.
That little 7-year-old girl was pretty enamored with you at dinner last night.
I know. That was hilarious.
Some little girl recognized him and ran up, wanted to take a picture with him. So,
no way.
Yeah, it was really funny. I'm sorry she didn't recognize you, Justin.
You can have that one.
What are you guys doing?
Oh, yeah.
Are you guys hanging out? You guys are doing an event, or you guys just happen to be in the same city?
No, we're doing a couple events. Cooking, yeah, I brought Brian up to do some dinner. He did a whole hog butchering class and demo at my restaurant yesterday. So I had a full house for that, which was awesome. And then we are spending the next couple days prepping that pig and doing a 6-course bourbon and whole hog dinner on Thursday. Pre the episode, and then we'll have a watch party after that.
I mean, this is one of the, I think, cool things that's happened with, and I think Top Chef is a part of it. I think generally just like people like loving ingredients and going to farmers markets, but like none of this shit happened in this country 20 years ago. Like,
oh, no.
I mean, you know, people, you know, younger chefs, you know, wouldn't necessarily had more trouble opening places, but just like the fact that you could kind of in a mid-sized metropolitan area have like a week's worth of cool culinary events and people will come out for butchering classes. This is kind of, it's a really nice time to be a chef in America. Like it's just cooler stuff. I mean, even 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I mean, that's just a blast.
No, absolutely. I think we're very blessed to be chefs in the time that we are. People are interested in what we're doing, so makes it easy.
Yeah. It's definitely, I mean, maybe I would say that like food TV has definitely played a role in piquing people's interest in, you know, sort of what we're doing. And then, you know, I mean, you know, people like Anthony Bourdain and, you know, just people watching him and then being like, wow, I mean, look at this guy who used to be like a total animal. And then, you know, he's actually like well-spoken and intelligent and like, you know, and so I think people are just curious, I think, to see what chefs are like, and it just makes people, you know, want to try to figure us out, which is funny because we're all just a bunch of, you know, lunatics running around working 100 hours a week.
Honestly, like watching it, I've said this 4 times on this show, it's like, I mean, what you guys do is like watching LeBron, and like, and it's actually inspiring. Like last night I was home alone, I had some games on, it was a Monday night, it was raining like hell in Los Angeles, so like it's a snowstorm basically, and it was like I've been looking for like kind of a new beet puree that I could put a piece of roasted, like a half chicken on, just something like, you know, fuck around with plating, get something like, and so I basically decided I took like the tahini in my cupboard and like roasted beets for 40 minutes, got them soft. And like, I made a beet like tahini puree for my roasted chicken and it was freaking fantastic. And
yeah, beet hummus. That sounds awesome.
Right. I mean, basically, that's what it does. I mean, I made it for fish, but it wasn't very good with the fish. So then I had a roasted chicken breast and did it that. But like, but that was something I learned, which is a very good accompaniment for chicken, not such a good accompaniment for halibut. But it's just like
Tom Colicchio's response to that dish, Ben? What would his comment be?
As long as there wasn't okra on it, he'd be fine.
Yeah. True. You know, I don't think he's a big fan of beets either. I know.
Oh. No, he hates beets, I'm pretty sure.
Beets are amazing. I think you would have lost
him there.
He put Kevin through the ringer for the beets and ricotta. You guys remember that? That was rough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that was just a fucked up dish, though.
I mean, it was a clean dish. I thought it was a clean dish. It was simple.
Brian, he's not on this podcast. You can rip him. It's okay.
I mean, you know, that was the first challenge, though. I think, you know, everybody was trying to figure it out, you know, and get their feet underneath him and whatnot. So I think he went with what he knew, you know, and I think he learned after that there's no such thing as playing it safe. You know, go big or go home.
Okay, before you go, guys, I want to ask Justin, was there any outtakes to the jacuzzi that we need to know about?
I think you saw everything you were supposed to see.
Okay. All right. And on that note, thank you guys so much for joining us and best of luck the rest of the season. I will note that you guys are on my team, not Kevin's. So when Kevin and I come into your restaurant, just remember which one drafted you guys. Just remember that.
Okay. Heard. Thank you guys.
Thank you, gentlemen. And this is Pack Your Knives.